webinar. I am going to start sharing my screen here in just a second and get rolling. Give me a moment. Right. Hopefully everyone can see my screen all right. So again, welcome, good morning, and thank you all for joining, taking the time this morning to be here with us. I'll get started. Our topic today is Introduction to Government Proposals and Source Selection Tips. And along the way, if you ask questions that steers us away from the core topic a little bit, that's okay. We have a small group, so we can always make this interactive. You've got plenty of time. My name is Reena Bhatia. I work with the NCMBC in the RTP region. And I hope that I have participants from my region as much as all across North Carolina. But I'm biased towards my region. So welcome anyways to all of you. Thank you for taking the time. Quick housekeeping. I hope that you take every opportunity to network with each other in the chat box. That's where you will put all your contact information, maybe a quick elevator pitch about your company, a sentence or two about what your company does, so we can all learn about you as we go back and look at these chats from everyone. And if you have questions, please post them in the Q&A box. I think we have a Q&A box, right? Yes, we have a Q&A box. So please post your questions in the Q&A box. My colleague Trent is going to be helping watch those questions. And Trent, we can wait till the end, or if you think it's appropriate while I'm on a slide to pull or ask a question, please feel free to interrupt me. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Again, good morning, everyone, and welcome. I hope everyone can see my slides. All right, so we are talking all things government contracting. And when NCMBC, North Carolina Military Business Center, when we talk government contracting, we are primarily focused on federal and DoD. We are not talking about state-level business, although if a company were to reach out to us for support on any government contracting, we are going to either help you ourselves or find other resources across the state that can help you. But for North Carolina, NCMBC is focused on helping companies grow and expand their federal and DoD business. And as we all know, as it happens each fiscal year, the government spends trillions, billions, if not trillions, of dollars in federal contracts. And 23% of those contracts go to small businesses. The number is, if you look at the percentage of awards for small businesses, 23% is the minimum. A lot of agencies far exceed this number, and therefore creating plenty of opportunities for small business to get into the government contracting and grow their ability to service the federal and DoD agencies. The idea is to sell your products and services to the federal government, but in order to do that, you have to meet specific requirements. We have a different webinar that goes into the basics. If you are not familiar with, well, how do I even get started? There are different webinars we do for that. And in fact, we also have and we'll be starting an academy to help you learn and do hands-on getting ready for federal contracting classes. But please watch for those webinars and attend those if you are brand new and don't know what those requirements are. I always say, and as a lot of colleagues, my peers in the industry will say, government contracting is not a mystery. It is difficult, it is not easy to do, but it is not a mystery. It's just a process like you would go through starting any other business. You would learn about it, understand the rules of engagement, be ready for it with the right registrations, and move forward. So there's nothing complicated about it. It's just a few extra steps, but that's why we are here to help you. Your taxpayer dollars are paying for us to be here. And so take advantage of us and learn to not just start your contracting business, but expand and grow and figure out what other sources of clients you might be missing out on. All right, getting into our agenda for today, again, the welcome remarks I just shared with you. Let's look at the North Carolina federal market. Just how big is this federal market just in North Carolina? Here's the overview. What does North Carolina look like from a presence, military presence perspective? This does not show the federal agencies that are located here. This chart focuses on military. We have the fourth highest active duty military presence across the United States. What does that mean for companies, for businesses? There's a whole lot of requirement to keep and sustain our active duty military on these bases that we have, installations that we have across the state. And so there are companies that will say, well, I don't know that what I sell, is there a need for it? Well, don't start with the assumption that there is no need for it. There may not be a direct purchase from the government, but there are different ways to do business with the government as a subcontractor, as a secondary supplier, and so on and so forth, depending on what you sell. But North Carolina has a very healthy military presence and therefore need for your products and services. We also have about 18,000 service members that transition out every year. What does that mean for you as a company? Workforce, trained, disciplined workforce. And we'd like for you to consider when you are looking at your hiring needs, know that 18,000 service members transition out of the military right here in our state. Let's create opportunities for them so we don't have a brain drain in our state. Let's retain that talent here and help our state grow. If you have workforce requirements, NCMBC has a workforce expert on staff, and we also collaborate with other state organizations to help you fill positions. So don't hesitate to reach out to your local representative for that as well. Coming back to the impact, how impactful is the military in the state on our economy, on our state's economy? 79.7, to be exact, almost $80 billion worth of revenue comes in to North Carolina through the military in different shapes, forms, contracts. You can see of that $80 billion, almost $9 billion came in as prime contract awards in fiscal year 22. We do need to update these numbers for the new fiscal years. But it's roughly about the same. $9 billion worth of revenue comes into the state because of military contract, federal and military contracts. I'm sorry, it's actually federal and DOD together would probably be more like 15 billion. So it's a huge chunk of our state's gross product. And that's because of companies like yours who go out and win these contracts, bring those dollars into the state. And again, you do not have to only bid on contracts where the work is in North Carolina. Work can be anywhere where you are able to perform. It's that you are a North Carolina registered company is what we are encouraging, and we'd like to see more of that. All right, let's look at the federal procurement. This is fiscal year 2023. You will see the spend here in billions of dollars. And 2020 was the pandemic. So there's a huge surge that happened. But the spending across the federal procurement spending from year to year, and we'll continue to see this, is going to go down. But when you consider that just in North Carolina, DOD spent almost $4 billion, there is still room for all of you to grow. And so we don't want this to be, oh my God, the spending is going down. Do I really want to get into, do I want to grow my federal DOD business? You absolutely do. There is still plenty of opportunities and room for you guys to grow your businesses in North Carolina and from North Carolina. This chart here shows, it's sort of like a heat map showing where the federal dollars were spread out. The reds are where companies brought in over $75 million in contracts, and it goes down. But really, the presence, your presence, doesn't matter what county you are in. First and most important thing is you have a local representative from our organization serving your county. Every county is covered. So if you need help, if you need assistance in understanding, growing, learning, we are here. Where you are present in North Carolina is not important. It is that you understand and learn about federal contracting and focus on getting those contracts, because majority of the time, your place of performance is probably going to be outside of the state. So your location within the state is important for us to assign you a, say, okay, who can help you? Who is your local representative? But I don't want this map to feel like, well, hey, I live in Cherokee and there's nothing here. I'm in Northampton and they don't do federal contracts there. Well, let's get Northampton on the map. Let's make the reds deeper reds. Let's make the light yellows deeper so that we can bring more contract dollars in. But this is generally the state of affairs of where the companies are saturated and where the dollars are coming into our state. All right, now for the core topic. And before I dive into it, let me take a breather and see, Trent, are there any questions or would you like to add to any of the information I shared?
We don't have any questions yet, Rena. And I think we're right on target with the presentation.
All right. All right, let's get into the, I know the topic of today's webinar is all about introduction to government proposals. But before we dive into writing the proposal, we got to understand where it all begins. And it sounds like I'm, saying, oh, let's take a history lesson. It isn't, although I love history, but we're going to talk about understanding why proposals are the last thing a government contractor should concern themselves with. While it is a very important part of your acquisition process and your contracting business, you first need to understand where and how it all begins in order to build strong proposals. It's like when people tell me, oh, I'd like to learn how to become a technical writer. And my first question to them is, do you like reading? If you don't like reading, you're not going to be a strong writer. If you don't understand the background and the history of how this all works, you're not going to build strong proposals. So let's dive into understanding the government acquisition process. Where do these RFPs even come from? And where and how, in your proposal process, can you use this information? And I apologize that this chart looks a little bit hazy. I have included the source of where I got the image from. It's from DAU's website. And I encourage you all, once you get this link, to go visit this source, because they actually have a deeper dive into just government acquisitions. And there's a nice little video on this as well. So it will be helpful to continue your learning beyond today's webinar to go check out the DAU website. So here we look at the first box on your left side that says mission requirement for supply or services starts the process. The number one thing is the government is a steward of taxpayer dollars, and every agency has a mission. They are going to spend money on things that support and deliver on their assigned missions. So that's where the requirement comes from. The people on the ground, people doing the day-to-day work in supporting their constituents, achieving those mission requirements, they know where their gaps are, they know where their requirements are, and it all stems from a person going, we really need to do this, or we really need to improve this system. We really need more supplies for X, whatever it may be. It starts there. It then goes through an acquisition process, and I am going at a very high level here, but within the government, there's a team that focuses on building the requirements, documenting those requirements, going through and understanding, okay, do we have the budgets for this? What might it cost us? What is our internal estimate? And so on and so forth. There's a whole team that works on all of these requirements. It's not just, hey, I'd like to go, buy a brand new IT system in place and somebody is, out calling Oracle or SAP to get it. Doesn't work that way. There are micro purchases. So, for those of you who are new to government contracting or very small and say, I do very localized services, how do I get those contracts less than 25,000, less than 100, 250,000? That's a different conversation, but it's still, even that requirement goes through a similar process, very streamlined, but a similar process. So there's a team that puts those requirements together, and you'll see in the center circle of all those people that have at some point influenced each of these steps in the process. The users and stakeholders, for those of you who come to us and say, how do I influence requirements? Well, users and the project managers. Those are two offices that influence or have a great deal to say about what goes into the requirements. Can you, quote unquote, influence the requirements if you know these people, if you can figure out who the buyers are? Or you might actually generate the requirement when you're talking to one of them and educate them on what your company's capabilities are and how you might improve their performance. And therefore, you now have influenced the requirement. That's what that means when you hear that term. But the government team goes through, documents the requirements, goes through the acquisition process within the government, identifying source of funding, internal government estimates, who will be on the source selection committee, and so on and so forth. While that is happening, they're reviewing all, the current strategy is being reviewed. There's a lot of oversight. This is not one person saying, I require something, and his buddy in the government saying, I know a buddy, and let's go buy it from that person. No, there are lots of checks and balances and a lot of people involved in this. And so when people tell us that, or at least when they talk to me, they're going, oh, I don't know that I want to do government, these government contracts because it's a buddy-buddy system. You got to know somebody in there. Not saying that doesn't help you, but there are a lot of other people involved in this process for you to think that it is that deeply wired and can be influenced that easily. It's not that simple. Now, once the government has its strategy in place, they generally will conduct a market research. And that is your sources sought, RFIs, request for information, or sometimes called market research itself. Read those and respond to those. If you don't have access to the users, if you don't have access to the project managers, you can still educate them on how and what is available that they might not have thought of. That is your first introduction and first step into proposals. Your proposal process begins at sources sought stage, responding to the sources sought professionally in a very detailed, not just answering what their questions are, but going beyond and understanding how do I help the government? How do I educate the government in understanding how my capabilities can do better? They have not considered some of my capabilities in their requirements. They probably don't know that your capabilities exist. And so responding to these market research notices is extremely important. If you guys have been, if any of you have been doing government contracting for a while, you will have noticed that last year, fiscal year 23 and 24, there were a lot of sources sought notices. More than RFPs, we saw a ton of sources sought notices. And so you have plenty of opportunity to respond and educate the government on your capabilities if you do it right. Companies get discouraged because they go, oh, we respond to all these sources sought and then we never hear back. We don't know what has happened with them. It's such a waste of time. It takes up my resources. I'd rather just focus on RFPs. I will tell you from my experience that yes, all of the above is true, but we have also managed to help companies get sole source contracts simply because it all started with responding to the sources sought notice. So don't get discouraged by that. You should look at it as an opportunity to talk to the buyers, the small business offices, and also, that is the government's way to determine if they want to set a contract aside for small business. If two or more qualified small businesses respond to the sources sought, the government has to set aside that contract for small business, or at least give a strong preference to small business. So again, I highly recommend and encourage you all to respond to those sources sought notices. And again, from a proposal standpoint, treat sources sought notices as you would any of your proposals. You plan it, think through, don't slap something together and throw it just because, oh, I found this yesterday and it's due today. These are not lengthy notices. They don't take much time. It's easier to make it professional than to throw something over and then have a first bad impression of your company. There are people on the other side. There are not robots actually reading this. So they're going to look at your proposal and or your sources sought response and say, okay, does this company really represent itself professionally? So make sure you at the very least, and this might sound very trivial, spell check and grammar check. I'm shocked at how many companies send me sources sought to review. And I'm going, all you had to do is do a basic spell check on this. So please be mindful of that. Make it professional. Here's a proposal tip for those responding to the sources sought notice. There is no compliance requirement. You are not being graded on compliance, unlike when you go into the proposal stage. So what does that mean for you, and why do I bring it up? Don't just limit yourself to answering the questions that have been asked. You do answer the questions that have been asked, but go beyond that. Read the statement of work. Do a thorough read of that and give the government recommendations on what other information would you like for them to include if this were to come out as an RFP. What are they not considering that your capability might be able to help them improve the requirements? That is your way of influencing the requirement. So don't worry about compliance. Don't say they asked for these five things and that's all I can put in there. You can go well beyond it. So use the market research as a way to introduce your company and your capabilities, but by helping the government improve its requirements document. Okay, so I spent a lot of time on that box because it is a very important box there. The requirements get further defined, refined based on market research that they get in. Sometimes they ask for estimates. The government wants to know, did we estimate this correctly? And so on and so forth. So it gets further refined. The acquisition strategy then gets more concrete because they can say, oh, there are small businesses qualified to do this. There are women-owned, service-disabled veteran-owned, hub-owned. Whatever the research might reveal itself, they then that gets into consideration in the acquisition strategy. When this acquisition strategy is being put together, one of the questions I often get asked is, Well, I know that I responded to it, and I know this buddy of mine who's also a small business responded to it, but this thing did not come out as a small business set aside. Well, there are several factors that go in that the government considers while they have asked for people companies to respond. The government is extremely risk averse, extremely risk averse. They are not going to take chances and on their mission impact. They're not going to take chances on spending taxpayer dollars without being prudent about it. So there are a lot of things that go into an acquisition strategy beyond just two companies responded, and therefore I must set it aside for small business. So that's where the acquisition strategy goes into effect. And then the government executes the strategy. What does that mean? There's a legal review of all the documents, turns into an RFP, gets released on SAM.gov, which is the official website where all government acquisition gets posted, is SAM, SAM dot GOV. If you are a North Carolina company, I also highly encourage you to register in our database, which is matchforce.org. So it's matchforce.org. But these RFPs start to come out. Companies respond, their contracts awarded, that entire strategy gets executed. And then once the contract is awarded, the government, the contracting office moves to monitoring and managing the performance of your work to make sure that you deliver what you promised in your proposals. And ultimately, they measure what results did this acquisition spending of these dollars have on their mission recipients, their end users. That may be the warfighter, the taxpayer, the whomever that agency services. Ultimately, it has to benefit and solve that mission requirement that they had in the first place. So this cycle continues on and on, and I hope that as I explain this, you also got some insight into the proposal process and why it is important for you to know this in order to build a strong proposal. Trent, any questions that I should address about this topic?
No questions yet, Rena. Just one comment that kind of popped into my head. When you're responding to a request for information or a sources sought notice, this is your opportunity as a company to sell yourself. This is your opportunity to make a lasting impression. And like Rena said, don't limit yourself to just answering the questions. If you're allotted 10 pages to respond, do your response, and you've answered their questions in five. Well, you've got five more pages that you can tell your story. So, just something to think about.
Thank you. And I don't know if Scott is still on the call here. Maybe I should not call on him. He warned me not to. Scott, are you still on? I'm going to assume he had to drop. So I was going to ask if he wanted to add anything to it. But let me keep moving here. And I'm sorry, I'm horrible with time. So I may not keep a good track of time here. I love to teach this and I get carried away. So now that we have understood the government acquisition process, let's move into, well, what does the industry's process look like? And believe it or not, the two sides are quite oblivious to the other side's process. And while we all tend to work and ultimately get to the same goal, the two sides work very, very differently. So the industry's acquisition process, and this is an oversimplification of the chart is an oversimplification of what actually happens. But at a high level, there are plenty of sources of where you can find opportunities. Federal government, state government, nonprofits, grants, R&D, just ton of opportunities out there. I mean, the government does spend almost $1.4 trillion, the federal government. So there is no shortage of opportunities. Absolutely, when companies tell me, oh, I can't find opportunities, is there enough in my industry? I can almost say it doesn't matter what industry you're in, there is no shortage of opportunities. And there are different sources, paid, unpaid, government sources, subscription databases. My recommendation, utilize all your free sources first. Do not go and spend on subscription databases until your business is ready for it. And at some point, you will be ready for it. You will need it. But until then, there are plenty of government and other sources that don't cost you a dime. Matchforce.org, register in their North Carolina companies. We actually send you opportunities that match your capabilities, so you don't have to sit and look at hundreds of them every day. We match them to your capabilities based on the profile you complete with us and send them to you. So utilize these resources. But in the acquisition industry, there's three important boxes that we need to learn, understand in the acquisition process. There's business development, there's capture, and then there are proposals. And I should have added one more layer down here is below proposals are your actual contracts. And why that is important to understand is that business development, capture, proposals, all these boxes that filter down opportunities that are best fit for you ultimately have to result in revenue, in dollars, in contracts for you. These are otherwise, you go through the exercise and say, I am not winning anything. I am not getting any business. It is important to get these right in order for all of this to turn into dollars for your company. Don't make this a paperwork exercise. That's not fun for anyone, and it certainly is not going to benefit you. So, opportunity sources I spoke about. Now, then, what is business development? What's the difference? And a very commonly confused thing that we see is what is the difference between business development and capture? It is not the person who is doing it. The same person can do both. Ideally, not, but we know that in a small business, people wear multiple hats. And so business development and capture can be the same person, but what they do, the function is very different. So let's look at that. If you, and this is an eye chart here, but I think it's very important that when you get these slides, you almost want to print this out and stick it to your desk or wall in front of you to remind yourself that in federal contracting, there is a need for these functions. So let's look at business development. What does business development do? Whoever is in that role, they identify or create opportunities. It's not always about just watching databases to see what is coming out. Business development is also in the function, in the role of creating opportunities for your company. That requires them to meet with the buyers, that requires them to meet with prime contractors, requires them to meet with whomever will buy your services to educate them on how your capabilities can solve their problems. Please don't approach any agency with, I have these capabilities, and you figure out how my capabilities help you. If you do that, you are going to be among those 90% of companies that end up saying that I never get anything after I submit a proposal. You start with, here are my capabilities, and here is how I can help your mission. That is good business development. You have done your homework and you are able to educate the customer on how you can help them, not let them figure it out. That is the role of business development. The timing is early stage opportunities. If you've probably heard this many times, by the time it is on SAM, it's too late. My personal opinion is that it is not too late. While you could have learned of there are plenty of other ways to learn of opportunities before it gets announced on SAM. The old adage of by the time it's on SAM, it's too late is an outdated myth. in my opinion. Again, it's my personal opinion, because of the success I have seen with companies starting their process at market research stage. So don't get discouraged by, and don't listen to those naysayers who say, oh, if you waited till it's on SAM, it's too late. No. But what can business development do to do those early stage opportunity identifications? You look at what other companies in your industry, your competitors, your aspirational companies, who are those companies you want to be like when you grow up? What are their contracts? What kind of work are they doing? Who did they market to? Who are their customers? What agencies? What departments? And all of this information is very easily available at no cost to you through FPDS, the Federal Procurement Data System, FPDS, or USA Spending, and both of these are .gov domains, .gov, FPDS.gov, USAspending.gov. And again, the other webinar that we do on all of this information on, federal contracting sheds more light on how to use these resources. But business development starts by identifying and creating opportunities from all these different sources. They do market research, they're networking, they're talking to prime contractors, they're talking to government buyers, they're attending industry days, they're attending conferences, they're building relationships and generating leads for the company. And if you've heard this term, what's your pipeline looking like? That's what they're doing. They're building a pipeline of opportunities. From my advice to companies would be, there is not a single pipeline. You should be building multiple pipelines. There are the must-win opportunities. There are the, hey, we have the capability, but we are not 100% sure. We're not sure where this goes. And then there are what the industry calls bluebirds, meaning the RFP just dropped on SAM. We didn't even know about this until 5 minutes ago, but let's take a chance and bid on those. So you should have your pipelines, or at least the single pipeline, segregated as such so that you know where to dedicate your resources, your limited resources, when it comes time to building proposals. But that's what the business developer or business development individual will do, build pipelines. They engage with multiple agencies, potential customers. We spoke about that. What are they producing for the company? They are producing market intelligence. Where is the industry going? Are we still competitive? What capabilities do we need to build and grow in our company to remain relevant? What am I hearing on the ground in terms of future spending? Spending cuts in certain agencies, so on and so forth. So they are keeping their hands on the pulse and bringing in market intelligence to the company, not just for specific opportunities, but overall. What are some of the potential leads? And that's your pipeline. And what is our positioning strategy? Why is this business developer recommending that you include that opportunity in the pipeline? And this is another area that I find companies make mistakes. They put every, ooh, I like this title. Ooh, I saw this on SAM. It looks like I can do this. Let's add it to the pipeline. Let's add it to the pipeline. And before you know it, your pipeline is out of control because you've added a bunch of leads based on the title of the opportunity instead of opening the RFP or the draft RFP or the PWS and reading what is required. This is the most frustrating thing for business owners, especially when you hire a business developer. The pipeline looks great on paper, but you are wondering, why am I not showing this? Why is this not reflected in my revenue? Because you have a pipeline that is basically a paper exercise, and you need to be careful not to build a pipeline that is paper exercise. But you'd rather have two real opportunities than 20. Oh, I looked at the title and it looked good opportunities. Okay, so that's what the business development side does. A business developer must be very strong in networking. I personally, again, I have a lot of personal opinions, so but this is based on 30 years of experience. When a business developer tells me I have a Rolodex and I can, talk to all these people and bring them to the table, take it with a grain of salt. Rolodexes go out of sync very quickly. They're outdated very quickly, especially if the person tells you that they've been out of an industry or an agency for more than, I would say 2 years, but let's just say 5 years. Anything beyond 5 years, your connections are outdated. Okay. So that whole I have a Rolodex, quote unquote, strategy of somebody saying I'm a business developer. I'm not saying don't believe it. Believe it, but take it with a grain of salt. Ultimately, you want someone who is able to network and build relationships for you, build those new contacts, and be a strategic thinker. It's not about one single opportunity. It's about how does it impact your company and how does that impact your revenue goals? And ultimately, if you can get the combination right, you have a healthy and real pipeline. Now, what happens? So the business developer did all of this. You have all these things you're doing. So what's the point of capture? What is this capture management that a lot of companies actually skip through and just jump from finding an opportunity to proposals? Well, if you look at successful companies, if you look at the large businesses, even successful small businesses at their own scale do this and do this very well. When an opportunity is identified, and as a company or as a CEO or leader of the company, you say, I have the resources, I have the capabilities to do this, then the opportunity gets shifted over to capture, to start mining and farming it, to say, okay, what are my showstoppers? Let's get technical people involved in this. Do we really have the technical capability to do this? What gaps do we have in our capability? What have we not seen that might prevent us? And most importantly, is it profitable to do this business? I think that's the number one question a lot of companies forget to ask themselves in early stages. Is this opportunity profitable? For example, what is the evaluation criteria? If it's LPTA, which is lowest price technically acceptable, do I want to do that? Because that's a race to the bottom. Am I a premium provider? And I know I cannot compete with wage determined labor force. I don't know how to recruit an admin assistant for $8.50. My admin assistant costs $30 an hour because it's quality. Well, skilled people is what I bring to the table. Well, think about all of that, and that's the role of capture. The business developer has moved on. They don't have time to dig deep and go deeper into an opportunity. The capture function does that. And when you think that the same person is doing both of these, that's not realistic in a company, because then you are doing constantly bringing opportunities and you're doing peripheral. I'm willing to take a risk and take a lot of risks and move on to proposal stage. And all of this, the business development function and the capture function, actually are what build successful proposals. All the knowledge that is collected during these stages, early stages of an opportunity, needs to get transferred over into your proposal. The capture manager is focusing on who my competition is. How am I going to win this opportunity? Yes, I have the capability. Do I have relationships with this agency? Do I have past performance? Can I demonstrate that I have, if I'm a 10-person company, that I have the financial resources to hire 300 people overnight? I've seen companies go out of business because of contracts that they won and they were not able to deliver. I actually worked with a company. They were a 30-person company. We won this contract for them. And I say we in my previous life, won a contract, 300-person contract. Amazing job, convincing proposal. The government gave them the contract. Well, lo and behold, 3 years into the contract, they were unable to sustain themselves because of improper costing. They did not, take into account, their CFO did not take into account the cost of money, the investment. You got to go from a 30-person company to a 300-person company. That is not an easy thing to do. So there are lots of things that go into building that. Do I want to win this contract strategy? And that's what a capture manager does. The capture manager is also responsible for transferring all this knowledge to help you build strong proposals. Because your competitive knowledge, how is the incumbent doing? Are they doing well on this? What is it that they're not providing today to the government that the government actually wants? That knowledge needs to get into the proposal. That knowledge needs to get transferred to the writer to say, hey, the incumbent is not meeting these requirements. Make sure that in our approach, we address that. So there's a lot of transfer of knowledge from BD to capture to proposals in order to build winning proposals. And I know that if you came here in this class trying to look for, show me how a proposal is written in a Word document, that's not what will win you contracts. So please understand this landscape, understand the difference between the functions of business development and capture. And if you are a small business that says, I don't have money to sit and hire all these people, that's okay. That only means that instead of chasing 15 opportunities, you will chase 4 opportunities, but do it and do it well so that you have time to think this through and build your strategy. You also, there are times when companies come to me and will say, oh, I need capture support. Well, what does that mean? What do you need in capture? Capture is a very broad term. You need to be able to define what specific intelligence or piece of information or knowledge are you missing in order for you to move this opportunity forward and commit to building a proposal on it. So please don't walk up to someone and say, oh, I need capture on this. It's more, be more granular. What is it that you're looking for? Okay. I think I've covered all of this. And ultimately, the capture manager or capture person's job is to position your company to have the highest probability of winning the contract. Making sure you have spoken to the right teaming partners, you have the NDAs and TAs in place, you all have discussed roles and responsibilities, work shares, all of that. And throughout this process, companies should constantly be building their profitability model. Do not ever forget that as you progress, you have to continue to think, is this still a profitable opportunity for my company? If you are bringing on teaming partners and you're giving away work share, you of a $15 million or a $10 million contract, you are not going to get all 10 million. You have a subcontractor that you just signed on. Now, did you give the subcontractor the most lucrative positions, or have you given them positions you didn't want to begin with because they were low margins? Where does your profitability stand? That's what a capture manager does and thinks about as you progress and mature through an opportunity. All right, let's now then dive into the proposal process. And I think I'm doing good on time. Trent, any questions I should answer at this time?
The Q&A box is empty, so I think we're doing well.
Either that or I've put everybody to sleep. I don't know. But I'm going to keep moving. Proposal process. Now that you've understood how the government builds its acquisition, all its requirements, how they put out the RFP, the draft, and so on and so forth, you understand the role of business development and capture that they play in helping you build a strong proposal. Let's look at the proposal process. This is a scary chart. When I show this chart to people, they're like, what? No, I'm a small business. I have one person. I don't have all these people sitting around. I can't afford to do this. Okay, these are roles and functions. One person can fit multiple titles here, but generally speaking, there's a proposal needs a team. It is not a one person job. And if it is, that one person at some point very quickly is going to burn out. You cannot run a business, write proposals, deliver on contracts, and sustain growth. Can you sustain your business as status quo? Yes, probably. Can you look at growth? Yes, at a very high cost. So try to build out a team, and not all these people are sitting on your payroll full time. And one person can do multiple roles. However, coming back to in an ideal world, this proposal team has the right resources. There's an executive sponsor or senior leader who has committed to spending dollars to have the right team members or the right SMEs and build this proposal. The capture manager we spoke about in the last slide, the capture manager's role is to continue to be a leader and decision maker on proposals. When there is a conflict, when there is a need for decisions to be made during the proposal process, it is the capture manager who has that responsibility to do so, because they, throughout the life of that opportunity, have collected a lot of intelligence and know the strategy that they built before moving to the proposal stage. So they remain in charge of making decisions. Successful companies that I have seen actually use their future program managers as capture managers. They hire the program manager and say, before we have won this program, while we are still in proposal stage, you are going to be the capture manager. The benefit of that is this capture manager, if they have done their job well and they've met with the government people, they've met with the prime contractors during this strategy phase, continue to see the same face implementing their project. And therefore, there's a relationship and a bond and more work that comes out of it without going through the proposal process. There are modifications that can happen, new sole source contracts that can come out of it. So think about this when you are thinking about proposals. Generally speaking, the capture manager becomes the program manager. It's a combination skill set, but if you can pull it off, it's a golden combination. The proposal manager is in charge of the proposal process, schedule, drives to the schedule in the process, but their decision making is limited to the proposal building. They don't make strategy decisions. They may recommend strategy decisions and collaborate with the capture manager. A lot of capture managers or a lot of proposal managers ultimately move up to being capture managers. So there is that understanding and skill already exists, but during the process, it's more collaborative and capture manager makes decisions. Proposal manager makes decisions related to the proposal process. Technical subject matter experts. If there's one person your company is going to hire, if you have no proposal team right now and you are in the market to hire a person, do not hire a proposal manager. Do not hire a proposal person. What you should be hiring is a technical person who is good at writing and has an understanding of the proposal process. Because the proposal process can be managed by a program manager or a detailed person. What companies don't have are technical SMEs who can read the RFP, articulate where the gaps are, and say, you know what, here's how we're going to tackle this and write an approach to this. So when small businesses tell me, well, I have a budget to hire one person in my proposal team, who should I hire? I tell them, hire a subject matter expert, hire a technical person. Don't hire a proposal manager if you have one person. As you grow, you will need other skill sets in that proposal team, but you will get more return on investment by having technical people on your staff as part of your proposal team than proposal managers and coordinators. Sometimes we have seen that SMEs are very good at what they do, technically articulating solutions, coming up with solutions, but they're not necessarily good writers. And so that's a transfer of knowledge, a little bit of tag teaming that needs to happen, and you need writers on your team. There's a coordinator, especially if it's a huge proposal. Your proposal manager is more driving the proposal strategy and oversight and reviewing, whereas the coordinator is doing more of the data calls, following up with people, managing the schedule, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, there are, the graphics designers that need to make the document look pretty, build your graphics. The government loves to see graphics instead of walls of words, and a picture speaks a thousand words as long as it's done well. So you need some good graphics people, but that's again not a full-time function. It's a collateral function in the company. And I should have actually moved this pricing lead to the very top. A lot of companies wait till the very end to build their cost proposal. They actually go through the whole technical management, past performance, blah, blah, blah. And then they're like, oh, but by the way, we also need to submit costs somewhere. My experience and my recommendation, build your cost first, or in parallel, start with your cost proposal simultaneously, because you're going to very quickly realize that if I go with what the technical SME is telling me to bid, I will be overpriced. If I have to cut cost and I have a certain number I'm trying to stay under, I better inform the technical team that they cannot build an approach assuming that they're going to have all these people on the team to implement. So there's a tag teaming that should happen between pricing and technical, which is the number one problem that I see in building proposals. The two work independently, and therefore the technical proposal is building a rocket ship, and the price proposal is delivering a Pinto. That's all the money you got, but you've promised a rocket ship, and the government is going to hold your feet to the fire and say, no, I want that rocket ship. You promised me that. I don't care how you do it. I don't care that you undercharged or you came up with wrong price estimates. I gave you an award for a rocket ship, and that's what I'm going to expect. So please tag team your pricing and technical. They should be in sync. And pricing people should attend proposal tag-up meetings. They think that they're going to wait till the very end and just tell me what you want me to fill out. Which Excel sheet do I need to complete? No, they need to be involved and hear what the technical side is doing so that when they start building that pricing, they're like, well, no, I overheard, or I know that the technical is taking this approach. I don't think we can do that, or I can't bill, whatever it may be, right? So, tag team there, and that's a very important role in the proposal process. Pitfalls to avoid: do not wait till the last minute to bill your cost. Your contracts manager is very important to review the terms and conditions of the contract. It is astonishing at how many companies have signed contracts and don't even know what FAR clauses, federal acquisition regulations, and what terms and conditions they have signed up to. You may not want to sign up to something if your product has foreign components to it, and you just signed off saying, "Oh yeah, I vouch that none of my supply chain is coming from overseas." You misrepresented. Just because you didn't read is not an excuse. Right? So please be mindful that it is important you read the restrictions. When you read the RFP, they can be very complicated. And so an experienced person with federal acquisition regulation experience, even if it's an outsourced resource or a part-time person, it is important that you have them review what you're signing up to. And then there are compliance reviewers. These are people who are reading the drafts of your proposal throughout to make sure you're on track. And the compliance reviewer is focused on compliance, not so much the responsiveness of the proposal. That's the role of the review team. So in a nutshell, these are all the different roles that go into building a strong winning proposal. So when you outsource, or you'll reach out to a third-party company to say, "Hey, I'd like help on a proposal," and they give you a price tag, and you get that sticker shock. Well, before you get the sticker shock, the right questions to ask would be, "What resources are included in helping me build my proposal? Why is it costing me as much as it is that you're saying it will cost me?" And so now that you understand what goes into building a proposal, you probably will appreciate, what you're asking, and asking the right questions when you decide to build your own team or outsource it.
Rita,
Okay.
we have a question.
Sure.
The slide that you just went over, it displayed a lot of individual roles. In your experience, how large are the firms who have this many people that they can dedicate to these individual roles? And perhaps a complimentary question would be, are there opportunities to consolidate some of these functions among, multiple individuals if you don't have that many people to spare in your organization?
Oh, 100%. And that's a great question. I thought I started with this, but maybe I missed it. These are not individual people sitting full time on a proposal. So, for example, you might have a technical person who also can write. You might leverage some of the newer technologies to improve their writing. So, these are not individual people. A lot of times, the technical SMEs come from your contracts that you're already working on, projects that you're already working on. You might tap on the shoulder of that person and say, "Hey, I need a couple hours of your time to read this and give me an approach, and then I'll hand it off to the writer in my office," or whatever it may be. So these are not full-time individual roles. The full-time function on a proposal, of a substantial size, when I say substantial, if it's a 30-day proposal, for anything over $5 to $10 million, you do need a full-time proposal manager. And a proposal manager can also do the function of proposal coordinator. It does not successfully go the other way. A proposal coordinator generally is not mature enough or experienced enough to also help strategize and catch things in the proposal, but a seasoned proposal manager can do the job of a coordinator. So you don't need two separate people full time on a proposal. A graphics person, you actually don't need a graphics person full time. You might use an outside resource to say, "I need these three graphics created," and that's all you're using them for. They're not sitting full time and we're dedicated to this proposal for the next 30 days. A contracts manager is generally a person who is also responsible for your invoicing, your billing. In a lot of small companies, the roles of contracts and accounting are blended. And so essentially, what you want is this person to read the terms and conditions of the RFP in the RFP. They're, again, not full-time people sitting around dedicated to a proposal. In terms of your review team members, if you have subcontractors, if you have teaming partners, that's where you leverage their participation in this process and say, "Hey, I'm going to need someone from your team to review the proposal once my writer has written to it." So they're not even your resources. Or you might, as an executive sponsor or leader, you might read that proposal and give feedback to the writer. So yeah, these are not one, don't make this a one-to-one correlation. Large bids, very large bids that I have managed as a proposal manager, I've actually had five, six proposal coordinators on them. So it also goes the other way. While smaller bids, you can blend the functions. On larger bids, there is one to many of these. But these are $100 million, $300 million bids where you're spend your investment. I always say a proposal is an investment. If you look at a proposal as a cost, you are betting to lose. If you look at proposal as an investment to a bigger contract, you're going to put in your positive energy and your mindset to go win something, to turn it into a contract. Don't write a proposal for the sake of making a pretty paper document. Write it knowing that there's a contract on the other end, and therefore it is an investment that you're putting in. So you look at the, how much should I invest? How much should a proposal cost me if the contract is $5 million annual revenue, or $5 million over 5 years, or $50 million annually? The proportion and the effort is going to change depending on the scale and the complexity of that proposal. Sometimes a very small proposal can get very complex. And so you want to make those kinds think through during the capture. And that's what a capture manager does, is they're going to think through and say, do I even have the resources to write the proposal? Can I find the technical SMEs? You might actually hire a technical consultant just for 5, 10 hours. You may not have them in your company. So again, not a full-time function, but you got to go find someone who has the skills. So think of these as skills, not as people. Very long-winded answer, Trent, to your question, but I hope I answered it.
I think that covered it, and we have another question that just came in, and it kind of goes back to the sources sought and the RFI responses. But if a supplier has an idea to present to the government and there's not now a current solicitation, how can I present a new proposal or a new concept for what I have to the government?
Great question. Generally speaking, when the government puts out an RFI, they have defined their need. There's usually a draft scope of work, or at least a little bit of information on what they're looking for. It's not simply, oh, Department of Commerce is looking for small businesses, answer these five questions. It's not how it works. They define what their need is. So if you have a completely innovative solution, the best time to do it is then. Answer the five questions, you know what their need is, and you go, traditionally the government will consider buying XYZ. However, we have this technology that can do what? Demonstrate value. Don't just say it's going to save you money, because that's not a selling point within the government. Yes, we all think that ultimately the government awards the contract to the cheapest bidder. Not always true. The government takes a more long-term strategic view at this. So if you do have an innovative solution, add to in your RFI response, tell them traditionally this is what you're going to see the industry propose. This is our new whiz-bang widget or solution, and here's why you should reconsider when you build your requirements, and here's what we recommend that you change in your statement of work to consider that this new technology is available. That's how I would do it.
And I'll add the Federal Acquisition Regulation at 15.6 does provide for an unsolicited proposal process. It's going to be fairly stringent on the requirements, but if you want to pursue that route, I'd be happy to talk to anybody offline, on the unsolicited proposal process as well.
Yeah, great point. Thank you for reminding me of that. There is the process. Every agency has on their website published how you can submit unsolicited proposals to them. But remember, an unsolicited proposal, if you are going down that route, your solution or whatever it is you are proposing cannot be for an existing requirement. So talk to Trent, he'll guide you through that. And give you more information, but that's also a great avenue, if not sources sought, for an existing requirement, how to do it versus using unsolicited proposals. Okay, I think we're getting low on time, so let me move quickly here. Successful proposals, read the RFP. I know it seems so basic. Read the RFP, please read the RFP. I get people who come to me and they're like, oh, can you help me with this? And I'm like, you haven't even read the RFP and you're telling me to review your proposal. Please read the RFP. And an RFP can be very complicated. It can get overwhelming. And it's like, well, I'm not reading 500 pages. Okay. I've narrowed it down for you. I've made your life a little bit simpler. If all you're going to read are some sections of the RFP, please read these. Look at that section A. Section A is actually the standard form. It's one page. One page, it looks like a bunch of complicated boxes, but here's what you're looking for. What is the set aside? If it is small business, what is the NAICS code assigned to this? And do I qualify as a small business under that NAICS code? Confirm that. Confirm the due date and time of the proposal. Look at any terms and conditions that they might have put in there that you are not willing to sign up to. So, basic, just basic solicitation document, the SF form, read that. Look at section B, which is your pricing document. How do they want you to structure your pricing? And is your business able to structure its pricing the way the government wants you to present it? A lot of times, companies can deliver, can do everything, but you price your products and your supplies differently than how the government wants you to break it out. Are you able to do that? So look at that before you start building your proposal. Then, well, maybe I should start with this. After your section A, the first thing you should look at is section C or the statement of work or a performance work statement, because that tells you the what. What does the government want from you? That's what it's saying. And if you can't deliver on that, it's a no-go. Let's not even talk about this. But start with section C, okay? Section A first. Do I have enough time to build this proposal? And do I qualify? Section C, can I do this work and where are my gaps? Then go to section L, your instructions for writing the proposal. Follow this to the T. Unlike the RFI and sources sought and market research, where compliance is not a problem, if you don't comply with the instructions of the RFP in the proposal stage, you will get disqualified. And that is a huge loss when you could have benefited the agency and their mission with the best solution. But if you submit a non-compliant proposal, the government will disqualify you. Section M is how are they planning on evaluating contractors? You need to understand how you're going to be evaluated and are you willing to live with that evaluation criteria? Do you bid on LPTA, the lowest price technically acceptable, LPTA bids? Do you bid on best value only? Your company may have different policies and strategies. Look at that, understand it. So read the RFP before you start writing your proposal. And if they're okay, I've given you five sections, but if you are lazier than I think you are, then how about just C, L, and M? Let's start there. Okay. And then we can worry about the other sections. But I know you guys are not lazy. I shouldn't have said that. The proposal process, if you know of Shipley, we give let's pay homage to the masters whose shoulders we stand upon. Shipley is an industry gold standard in the proposal process. Do I expect you to follow them to the T? No. Different bids require you to be agile, be flexible in that process. But generally speaking, the proposal strategy has been built and presented to the proposal team by the capture manager and the proposal manager. The proposal team has a proposal plan, which is your schedule. Who is writing what, which section, who are the writers, who are the reviewers, so on and so forth. And once you'll see in the light blue, the proposal plan starts with implementing the strategy. You have a kickoff, it's a kumbaya, let's all go, let's go win this thing. The writing happens, The reviews happen and submissions happen. The Shipley process, or you will hear this very commonly in the industry, the quote unquote color team reviews. Those are nothing but different reviews at different stages of maturity of your proposal, giving the writers feedback on how they can improve. So there's kickoff, there's review zero, there's writing, review one, review two, review three, and then the final, you submit the proposal. As a company, as a successful proposal process, your job doesn't end when you have submitted the proposal. Every proposal should be followed by an after-action review. What did we do well? What did not work? How do we avoid mistakes we made on this proposal on our next one? And so on. Sometimes the government will come back with evaluation notices. Sometimes they come back with, hey, you need to clarify your proposal. So there is still post-submission support that needs to happen. If you choose to protest because you did not win the contract, then your legal team will need the proposal team's help to demonstrate that you did, in fact, respond to things the government says they, you lost over or what have you. So that support that is part of the process. Then you win the contract. Fingers crossed, you have done all your good work in BD and capture stage, and the proposal was a nice bow tie, and you won it. You ask the agency for a debrief. Whether you win or lose a proposal or a contract, you should request a written and/or a verbal debrief from the agency so you can learn what you did well and how did the government evaluate you, what you could have avoided, in the mistakes you could have avoided from their point of view, and keep continuously improving your proposal process and strengthening it. All right, source selection tips. I'll cover this quickly. Very basic. Your important thing is to understand how you're going to be evaluated. You have to write to section L, the instructions, but you have to keep in mind how you're going to be evaluated. So the structure of your proposal cannot change or vary from section L, but the content you put into that outline, into your proposal, should be driven by section M, which is your evaluation criteria, and also still respond to the requirements, section C. Develop a strong compliance matrix. This is not necessarily a separate document like the traditional Shipley tells you to do, is build this compliance matrix and check off boxes. There are many different and more efficient ways of doing this. Happy to take it offline if somebody wants to talk to me about how do you build and use a compliance matrix without creating additional documents, reach out to me. If you are going to bid on something, have a differentiating solution. If you are going to be a me too, like everybody else, then it's going to come down to cost. So differentiate your solution, or you're going to differentiate yourself on pricing. And regardless of how good and value added you are, if your pricing is out of sync from what the competition is doing, or what is considered reasonable, the government will not award you the contract. You must leverage your strong past performance. If you don't have your own past performance, there are many different ways, and maybe we'll do a webinar all about how do I bid on government contracts when I don't have past performance. That might be a great topic to talk about separately. But leverage good pa strong past performance and write for the evaluators, not just for the SMEs. This is very, very important. The source selection committee is a mix of technical and non-technical people. Yes, you need to get geeky and geek out and tell them all about all, how your approach and how you're going to solve this technical problem. But there are also executives on the selection board or folks, staff on the selection board that will not understand your technology only. So when you present your approach in your proposal, it is important to simplify it and also write to this is what my solution means to you? How does it benefit your agency? And that's what the non-technical evaluators will gravitate to. So balance out your writing. You must conduct rigorous proposal reviews. Bad proposals, non-compliant proposals, non-responsive proposals are a bad impression. So please don't submit proposals without them going through reviews. Submit early. Do not wait till, if the proposal is due at 12 o'clock, don't wait till 11:59 to start sending the email. Plan your proposal schedule such that you are ready to submit at least a day before, especially with the new portals that the government is asking contractors to upload files to. Those can be problematic, especially if all contractors on popular bids on IDIQs, we have noticed that all contractors jump in a day before. All of them are trying to upload their files 2 hours before it's due, and it brings down the system. The systems have crashed because of that. Is that the government's fault? No. No, that is no excuse for you to say, well, I was ready to submit, your system went down. The government doesn't care. You have a deadline, and it's up to you to make sure you submit early. And then prepare for those post-submission activities. What I mean by that is maintain your documentation and your evidence of how you build stuff, especially your cost proposal. The RFP might not require you to disclose all your buildup, but if the government comes back and says, can you justify to us how you came up with this cost? You should have a buildup ready to go. You should be able to clarify, and that's not the time to reverse engineer. How did I charge $100 for my program manager? How did I come up with that? That's not the time to do it. Make sure you've done it right, built up your evidence, maintain it. You will also need it, even if the government doesn't come back and ask you for it. When you go to implement your contract, you will need to know, your program manager will need to know, what am I managing to? What are my margins? What salaries can I afford to pay these people? Yes, we're charging the government $100, but what can I afford to pay? What salary ranges can I afford to recruit in? Your implementation team will also want to know. So when you're preparing your proposal, keep in mind you're not preparing a proposal for the sake of a pretty paper. There's a contract on the other end. So if you do it right from the beginning, you are ready to win the contract and implement it well. All right, the next few slides, I'm done with my topic. Quickly introduce for those of you who are wondering, what is NCMBC all about? I did talk a little bit about it earlier. We are a state entity. We are an entity of the state of North Carolina. So when any of us, our BD folks, call you and say, hey, we'd like to learn more about your company, we're not tax collectors. We're not calling to tax you. We're calling to help you. You pay us to do this. So leverage us, reach out to us, use us to help you grow your business. We are statewide. We're focused on federal and military business, but we have a team of folks that sit across the state, and we leverage our community college systems. Thank you to all the community colleges across North Carolina who host us. That way, your taxpayer dollars are not being wasted on overheads and rents and equipment and those kinds of things. They are being put to more use to help you. And so there's a collaboration with the community colleges. You will find most of your local representatives within your local community college system. I spoke about our mission and goals. And really, since the beginning, we have helped North Carolina companies win over 6,000 contracts and bring in over $18 billion to the state of North Carolina. Not to mention, and these are just prime numbers. We don't have the ability to track subcontract dollars that our companies bring in through our efforts of helping you find teaming partners, to help you find vendors, and those kinds of things. So the numbers are actually much higher. And of course, we help create more jobs in the state, which is what we all want. This is a map of our business development team. You'll find this on our website as well. And when you get a copy of this presentation, you will see it. Your local representatives' names, phone numbers, email addresses are all here. Even if you don't have any need right away, reach out and say hello to us. We like hearing from our North Carolina companies. We like to know what your capabilities are because there might be a prime contractor looking for a teaming partner. And if we know that you exist, then we are more likely to recommend you. So please reach out to your local representative. All right, I spoke about MatchForce. That's one of the tools that is freely available to you. Register yourself. We go there looking for companies to direct the government to direct the prime contractors to when they're looking for teaming partners. And if you don't exist in MatchForce and we are not able to find you, you might be missing out on opportunities. So please register. We also have an arm of our company. And Trent, you asked me about what about those innovative technologies? If you have not heard of DefTech, that is part of NCMBC, we highly encourage you go to our website, to also the DefTech's website. They have a separate website as well. Please learn all about them. And Bob Burton, our director of DefTech, does a fabulous job, him and his team, of hosting every Friday. There's a virtual and in-person networking and opportunity to present your company's capabilities. There are a lot of government folks who attend this. So if you have not heard of this and you've not attended in the past, I highly encourage you to do so. This group focuses on all innovative technologies that can help our DoD. Finding opportunities and next steps. Let's go. You now have learned of the process. You know how to improve your chances of winning through good proposal management and proposal processes, business development, capture. Here are some of the resources available to you. Leverage them. And again, I think the best thing to do is reach out to us, your local representatives. I have concluded just in time. I thank you and our executive director, Scott Dorney, director of operations, Courtney Smedic, and the presenter today, me. So again, reach out to us. Thank you all for your time. Trent, more questions? Happy to answer.
Well, one last point back on the proposal development process. As you review a government solicitation, please remember that those are prepared by humans on the government side, and they can have mistakes, they can have errors, they can have conflicting information between sections. So if you see something that's confusing, that you don't understand, please submit a question to the contracting officer within the time allotted for Q&As. And oftentimes that can mean the difference between submitting a price that's in line with what the government's really looking for, or you may accidentally submit a price that, based upon your interpretation, is not what the government intended. So take advantage of the Q&A period.
Yeah, good advice there, Trent. Thank you. And you're right. It is as much as we'd like to think they're using AI technology, they don't. There are human beings preparing these RFPs. All right. Well, if there are no other questions, I appreciate everyone joining us today. And hopefully this information was useful. I know it was very high level. Plan to attend whenever we announce it. The Defense Contractors Academy will be talking, we'll be going deep diving into building proposals and all things government contracting. So look out for that. Join us. NCMBC has great networking events coming up. I hope you all attend because part of building strong winning proposals is strong BD and strong capture, and that begins with networking. Thank you for networking today in the chat box, and I look forward to meeting some of you in person at our events. Thank you all.